Vivaldi's Winter Largo comes in to remind us that we've come together to share this evening under lamplight on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, taking over the space here in the studio from Kipper the Cat and his pals. You should see the way Kipper asserts his control of the studio and keeps everyone in line. Maybe I need a mascot for this show, too. I can't imagine what it would be. But now, as always, I invite you to attend. The shows during this third series of Evening Under Lamplight have all featured readings from Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, a long poem that we are gradually working our way through bit by bit. I've always believed in focusing narrowly and going deeply, and so I try to organize each show to connect with whatever Whitman is speaking about for the week. This week, there are descriptions of men at work, and so our theme is work and workers. Where to start? I think we will start with one of my favorites, whom I have brought onto the show several times in the past. I'm speaking about Fraggle Rock, which I think was Jim Henderson's masterpiece. Fraggle Rock itself was a location that housed many different kinds of creatures. A human being and his dog at one level. At another level, the Gorgs, inept monsters. He, the king, she, the queen, but no subjects except their feckless son. Then there were the Fraggles, a group who played all day, devoted to enjoying themselves, but also, as the main focus of the episodes, creatures who each week struggled to cope with various problems life presents, offering the viewers a simple but never simplistic theme, such as knowing when you need help from others, doing or refusing to do what others expect of you, looking inside yourself, being okay with being afraid, and so on. The show was full of sentiment, but there was so much fun that it never became sentimental, and the plotting and brief characterization, and most of all, the music, were all so good that we can delight in these shows over and over. Oh yes, and there was the final group of creatures inhabiting Fraggle Rock, the Doozers. Tiny figures, usually with no distinguishing features, usually depicted as endlessly working in the background. Doozers wear hard hats and drive little carts or construction vehicles and carry tiny pneumatic drills. They spend all their time constructing intricate bridges and other works made of doozer sticks, small rods of a sweet, edible substance derived from radish dust. Now, radishes, do you really need to know this? No, but why not? Radishes are the Fraggles' favorite food, and so the Fraggles spend much of their time eating up the doozer constructions. That's no disaster, though, since it ensures that there is always a need to build more constructions and thus ensures that there is a continuous supply of work for the doozers. The ideal situation for these doozers who want to do nothing else but work. The Fraggles, on the other hand, want to do nothing else but play. I'm now going to quote for you from the Muppet Wikia, an interesting site you might want to have a look at yourself. Here's what we learn there about the doozers. The doozers all live together at the Doozer Dome. They work together in a society that values cooperation in order to further the common good, which is very much contrary to the Fraggles, who place a high value on individualism and independence. The doozers pride themselves on the good work that they do, but no doozer is allowed to take personal credit for their work. That would mean that they thought their work was better than everyone else's and would be destructive to the communal spirit. Competition is seen as a vice that occasionally afflicts doozers. Again, this is very unlike the Fraggles, who love to have races and competitions and to take pride in their individual jobs and passions. Isn't that lovely? Fraggle Rock offers us two different kinds of society, one intensely cooperative, the other intensely individualistic. We get to watch the contrast between these two systems. Can you conceive what such a thing can do for a child's imagination? In the first episode they ever televised in 1983, the Fraggles sit around thinking about the various occupations they have. Gobo is occupied with receiving postcards from his traveling Uncle Matt out in the big world. Moki ventures into the Gorg's garden to bring back radishes for everyone. Boober, the nerd, loves to do the laundry and the cooking. The more boring the job, the better for him. Give me work that's boring, boring to the core, a job that goes on much too long and then goes on some more. And finally, Red, the go-getter, who competes at swimming. But Wembley, the fifth member of this group of friends, has no occupation. What is he going to do? Well, here's the song as he finds himself alone in the crowd, as all the Fraggles seem to find themselves at one time or another, and his friends rejoice in their playful occupations, and the Doozers in the background keep up their own steady work. It's a remarkable song, beginning with the word workin' repeated 16 times before the song actually begins. It's a catalogue song of all the work the Fraggles have to do. Your duty's always waiting, duty must be done, there's ping-pong games that must be played and songs that must be sung. And Red dives and splashes in the pool to keep the water clean. That's a nice job. Oh, and don't forget also to attend to the witty music, as good as anything you'll hear elsewhere.
Get yourself to work. Fraggles never fool around. Fraggles never shirk. Your duty's always waiting.
Duty must be done. There's ping pong games that must be played and songs that must be sung.
Working, 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 working.
I'd like to tell the story of what my work is for. A tale of toil and gathering and radishes and more. But don't forget my mighty job, the lonely tough routine. I dive and crash and swim and splash to keep the water clean.
Working, 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 working,
that must be played and songs that must be sung.
have I really spent so much time talking about the Fraggles? Well, why not? To paraphrase Samuel Johnson, a person who is tired of Fraggles is tired of life. But then there are those who get tired of their work or tired from their work. Here's a song I've known for a long time, but I'm not sure it's very familiar to many others. Do you know Joe Tex? Let's hear his song Bad Feet, a celebration, if that's the right word, of the way his job is killing his feet with all the hours he spends walking around. This is a poor man's song, the song of a man who doesn't earn enough money to buy decent shoes that properly fit, but also the kind of man who's going to have to be on his feet more than most. I go to work every morning on these bad feet. I stand up 7 days a week on these bad feet. Now, some people make their living sitting down and don't get out of breath. If I had to make my living sitting down, people, I'd starve to death. I got a corn on my left foot. I got a callus on my right. I can't wait to get off of my job so I can soak my feet at night. He can't wait to soak his feet at night, but then when he comes in, his woman wants him to go out dancing. And here we get one of the famous Joe Tex recitatives. Baby, you know I told you I was going to take you out to that dance at night, but I don't think I'm going to be able to go. My old feet hurts me so bad. Won't you just stay in and help me work on my feet so I can go to work on Monday morning? But then Tex gives us the woman's reply in falsetto, refusing to stay in, threatening to go out with some other guy if he can't take her. And so, I guess I'll have to go dancing on these bad feet. I don't know how long I can dance on these bad feet. Now, these old feet have been some mighty good feet. Lord, I can't tell no lie. I'm going to buy them the best pair of shoes anybody's money can buy. Well, good luck to him and his feet and his new shoes if he can get them. Here's Joe Tex. Watch how much lively excitement he puts into the song. I don't know what kind of job Joe Texas Bad Feet Man was complaining about. But we next have someone who can really complain, a man who seems condemned to hard labor. This is a song by Josh White called Like a Natural Man, a work song punctuated by the heavy beat, presumably as the shovel clears another load from the trench in rhythm with the other workers. The song starts off with a cheerful ditty about God making a monkey, a whale, a gator, and other fairly harmless lines, just to keep up the rhythm. But then it stops with a whale crying out for the water boy. It's hot out there in the South, man. It's a clever playing around with the voice, but that thirst is no joke. And there's a kind of desperation when he resumes the ditty. Then a kind of joy after the water boy tells him that tomorrow is payday. Then the thirst hits again. Let's attend.
You gotta pick up your shovel, dig a hole in the sand, grab your shovel, shovel sand like a natural man, like a natural man, natural man, natural man, like a natural man. God Almighty made a monkey, God Almighty made a whale, God Almighty made a gator with hickeys all over his tail, all over his tail, over his tail, over his tail, over his tail. Matter when you marry, get a railroad man. Every day'll be payday. A dollar bill in your hand, a dollar in your hand, in your hand, in your hand, in your hand. Getting kind of thirsty. Oh, bring that water. Set that bucket down. Water boy. God Almighty made a monkey. God Almighty made a whale. God Almighty made a gator. With hickeys all over his tail, all over his tail. Over his tail, over his tail, over his tail. Payday tomorrow, how do I know? Haven't told the water boy, the water boy told me so. Well, he told me so, he told me so, he told me so, he told me so. Water boy, oh, water boy, it's getting kind of thirsty, oh, bring that water, set that bucket down, water boy.
Well, this is hard work, and it sounds like this guy is working in a gang of workers. But since he's talking about getting paid, I don't imagine he's working on a chain gang, which was comprised of prisoners sent out to work on the roads or other necessary jobs no one else would do. A line of men chained by the ankles, knowing they were condemned for years, decades probably, to this unremitting labor, while longing for a bit of rest and for a chance to be with their loved one again. Sam Cooke's song Chain Gang was a hit in 1960. Cooke got the idea for the song when he came across a chain gang and gave the guys several cartons of cigarettes, probably the best present he could have given. The song itself feels a little too upbeat for such misery, but as usual, Sam Cooke's voice brings us a range of emotions, which no other version I know conveys. And then there's the steady clank of the hammer on metal as they work together. Notice that he too is thirsty, though not quite so plaintive. Maybe there was no water boy for chain gang prisoners. Nobody to call out for water. Just the guard with his gun, watching.
I hear something saying. Chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, that's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang, that's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang, all day long they work so hard till the sun is going down. Working on the highways and byways and wearing a frown. You hear them moaning their lives away, then you hear somebody say, that's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang, that's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang,
can't you hear them saying, I'm going home one of these days. I'm going home, see my woman whom I love so dear. But meanwhile, I've got to work right here.
That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang.
All day long they're saying, my, 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 my. My work is so hard, give me water. I'm thirsty, my. My work is so hard.
Sam Cooke's Chain Gang, tough manual labor. But how about white-collar workers? As Joe Tex said, some people make their living sitting down and don't get out of breath. But they get bored, and they too still have to deal with unfair bosses. You remember Dolly Parton's complaints about her 9-to-5 job.
Out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind.
To shatter, you're just a step on the boss man's ladder, but you got dreams he'll never take away. In the same boat with a lot of your friends, waiting for the day your ship will come in and the tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way.
Working 9 to 5,
what a way to make a living.
Barely getting by,
it's all taking and no giving.
They just use your mind.
Thank you.
They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. And no hope of promotion for all the work you do. But you got dreams they'll never take away. Here's the country western sentimentality. Or the same thing this time in London. Like Dolly Parton, the Kinks also called their song 9 to 5, followed immediately by When Work Is Over, as the bored desk worker can find relief only by rushing to the bar. There's sentimentality here, to be sure, but so colored with irony that it just grips us with its pathos. He's checking a list that's been checked out before, and he's starting to lose his mind. And then again, drinking helps us to forget what we are. Not who we are, not where we are, but what we are. Drinking helps us to forget what we are. We leave the office and go straight to the bar. Don't stop and think. Have another drink.
Answering phones and dictating letters, making decisions that affect no one, stuck in the office from 9 until 5. Life is so incredibly dull, working from 9 to 5. Oh, 9 to 5, 9 to 5, working from 9 to 5.
And time goes by.
Living by the book and the rules and regulations. have another drink.
Two white-collar work songs from the Kinks album Soap Opera. By the way, this celebration of mindless drinking does not reflect the principles or opinions of this station, and we would like, of course, to remind you to drink responsibly, even if you're stuck in an office, like the Kinks Norman from 9 until 5. You're listening to Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, all coming your way on Cambridge 105, the community radio in your city, with a wide variety of shows. No, I mean it. It's not just some promotional hype. There really is a wide variety of shows, and all are local. Most local radio stations include some local material combined with a great deal of nationally syndicated programs, but everything here, or well, almost everything, comes from people in and around Cambridge. Come to the website, cambridge105.fm, and browse through the schedule and get in touch if there's something we're missing or if you're interested in helping out or even in doing your own show. And I can personally attest to the friendly community spirit that pervades the place here. Well, okay, now let's move on to Walt Whitman. We're looking at sections 12 and 13 of Song of Myself. As usual, we begin with reading the passage. The butcher boy puts off his killing clothes and sharpens his knife at the stall in the market. I loiter, enjoying his repartee and his shuffle and breakdown. Blacksmiths with grimed and hairy chests environ the anvil. Each has his main sledge. They're all out. There is a great heat in the fire. From the cinder-strewed threshold, I follow their movements. The lithe shear of their waists plays even with their massive arms. Overhand, the hammers roll, overhand, so slow, overhand, so sure. They do not hasten. Each man hits in his place. The Negro holds firmly the reins of his four horses. The block swags underneath on its tied-over chain. The Negro that drives the huge dray of the stone yard, steady and tall, he stands poised on one leg in the string piece. His blue shirt exposes his ample neck and breast and loosens over his hip band. His glance is calm and commanding. He tosses the slouch of his hat away from his forehead. The sun falls on his crispy hair and mustache, falls on the black of his polished and perfect limbs. I behold the picturesque giant and love him. And I do not stop there. I go with the team also. In me, the caresser of life, wherever moving, backward as well as forward slewing, to niches aside and junior bending. Oxen that rattle the yoke or halt in the shade, what is that you express in your eyes? It seems to me more than all the print I have read in my life. My tread scares the wood drake and wood duck on my distant and day-long ramble. They rise together, they slowly circle around. I believe in those winged purposes, and acknowledge the red, yellow, and white playing within me, and consider the green and violet and the tufted crown intentional. And do not call the tortoise unworthy because she is not something else. And the mockingbird in the swamp never studied the gamut, yet trills pretty well to me. And the look of the bay mare shames silliness out of me. Well, there are several sections here. The description of the butcher boy, then the blacksmiths, then the black driver of the cart in the stone yard. And then we move away from these workers to various animals. Oxen, wild fowl, tortoise, mockingbird, and bay mare. Each item in this catalogue is a source of wonder to Whitman, and by extension, he hopes, a source of wonder and delight to us too. Whatever I assume, you shall assume, as he told us at the beginning. So let's attend to these little pictures. There's the butcher boy, putting off his killing clothes after slaughtering an animal, or as butchers do, he's sharpening his knife, that quick, deft, back-and-forth swishing of the blade on the sharpening stone, getting ready to cut the meat for some customer. All the time the butcher is talking, and Whitman is standing by listening to the guy talking back and forth with the customers, sharpening his wit against them as he sharpens his knife against the whetstone. I loiter, enjoying his repartee and his shuffle and breakdown. Whitman speaks of his shuffle. Not an easy word to place here. I think he means the butcher's witty exchanges, shuffling the repartee back and forth, shifting his own position depending on what the customer is saying. Or it could just be that this butcher is shuffling, dancing around as he serves customers. The breakdown, after all, was a kind of riotous country dance, though Whitman could be using it here metaphorically to suggest the kind of wild banter that goes on in the market. In any case, to get a flavor of this butcher boy's crazy repartee, whether in words or dancing, let's loiter ourselves for a few minutes with one of the great breakdown tracks, Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs' 1949 recording of Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Take it away. How was that? Flatt and Scruggs' Foggy Mountain Breakdown, giving us the spirit of the butcher boy in the marketplace whom Whitman is observing. Hey, I wonder if Flying Fingers, the theme music from Soupy Sales, can also be called breakdown music. I can never resist playing it, so here it is, just for the joy of it. Thank you. We're getting a little silly, but we'll see soon that Whitman knows how to deal with silliness. Because now we move on from that butcher boy to the blacksmiths, a more serious group of men with grimed and hairy chests, standing poised around the anvil upon which is some heated piece of metal to be pounded into shape. Each man has his sledgehammer. The fire is scorching hot, and no doubt there's a boy or two with bellows keeping the fire at its highest pitch. And there's Whitman, as he is everywhere, just looking on. He's at the door of the blacksmith's workshop, the cinder-strewed threshold, where bits of cinders and ashes from the fire have collected. Whitman says he follows their movements, and we can imagine the interest he takes in these men's bodies at work. The lithe shear of their waists plays even with their massive arms. What is this lithe shear? Whitman is again importing technical words from other occupations. The shear is the upward curve of the deck of a ship at the bow or stern. And so here he must be speaking of the way these men's waistline curves outward up to the much broader torso of the chest. I'm not sure what it means that this lithe shear plays even with the massive arms. Is it that the muscular arms curve outward in the same way as the torso curves outward from the waist? Maybe I'm just obtuse, but never mind. I can tell that Whitman at least has attended to these men's powerful bodies and is fascinated by them. And he very carefully registers the way the men all work together, each one bringing down his hammer methodically to help shape the iron. Overhand the hammers roll, overhand so slow, overhand so sure. They do not hasten, each man hits in his place. Then the shift to the next image, the Negro driver, expertly handling the horses. He's in charge of the wagon in the stone yard. We have to act almost like archaeologists as we try to piece together these scenes from the past. This would be an area where huge hunks of stone, marble, granite, or some other stone, are delivered and then cut into appropriate sizes, blocks for building, or curved for delicate stairways or windows, or memorial stones, or whatever. And the cart that brings in the stone also carries out the cut stones, delivering them where they're going to be used. The cart is a dray, low-slung, heavy, and sturdy. And you can imagine what a heavy load this would be. To carry it requires four strong horses. A dray usually had no sides, just a flat surface, and if it got out of control, there was the chance that the load could shift and fall off the cart, ruining everything. The driver, therefore, had a lot on his hands and needed strength and great skill to control the horses and negotiate the heavy, awkward load. The block, the lump of stone, swags or sways, though it is kept secure with chains. And there he stands, this driver. Steady and tall, he stands poised on one leg on the string piece. This string piece is perhaps that long piece of timber holding together the parts of the dray. But we can guess that this man is taking a flamboyant pose up there, almost showing off how confident he is and how easily he can handle his tough job. He's something of a show-off too, it seems. Whitman's eye goes for the details, this glorious moment amidst all the rush and noise of busy New York. His blue shirt exposes his ample neck and breast and loosens over his hip band. His glance is calm and commanding. He tosses the slouch of his hat away from his forehead. The sun falls on his crispy hair and mustache, falls on the black of his polished and perfect limbs. I behold the picturesque giant and love him. And I do not stop there. I go with the team also. There's a homoerotic element here, to be sure. Whitman's eyes fixed on this man's perfect body. But when Whitman says he loves this picturesque giant, I think we have to take this in a wider sense, the sense that Whitman appreciates this man for what and who he is, No judgment, just admiration. That's the higher form of love. And this love extends not only to the picturesque giant, but to the team, the horses. Whitman appreciates them too for what they are, and they are lovely, lovable, because, as he says next, he caresses life wherever moving. With this, he moves himself from the workhorses to oxen, another kind of work animal. Oxen rattling the yoke at work in the fields or halting in the shade. And now he goes back to an approach he'd used before, asking a rhetorical question of wonder and then expressing his wonder. Oxen that rattle the yoke or halt in the shade, what is that you express in your eyes? It seems to me more than all the print I have read in my life. More than all the print I have read in my life. Here's Whitman following Ralph Waldo Emerson's advice to turn away from all the writings our culture has loaded us with and go out to observe life firsthand. I don't know how many oxen are available for us today to be attentive to, but that's okay. We can just look at a dog or a cat or at a bird out of our window, or even what Whitman elsewhere calls the noiseless patient spider. There's wonder enough there. Or we can look up at the stars, as Whitman does in a short poem that is a clear expression of the quintessence of Whitman's vision of life. Let's pause for a moment to consider When I Heard the Learned Astronomer. When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures, were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and the diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself into the mystical, moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. This poem often comes back to me at academic conferences, I'm afraid. But the key here is that act of looking up at the stars in perfect silence. It's not all that easy to look in perfect silence. We have to empty ourselves, and most of us can achieve this only very briefly. Still, if we build the habit, we not only become better able to sustain this perfect silence, but also we actually might become more wise, if not more learned. But we've wandered from the animal catalogue Whitman has been giving us. From the oxen, we move to the wild fowl, also objects of wonder. We're no longer in the city or on the farm, but far out in the countryside, where Whitman is taking his distant and day-long ramble. My tread scares the wood drake and wood duck on my distant and day-long ramble. They rise together, they slowly circle around. That's the situation, that sudden rush of birds up into the air. Now, in what way does Whitman engage in this moment? He accepts that there is a purpose in their action and intuits that this purpose, whatever it is also present within himself. I believe in those winged purposes and acknowledge the red, yellow, and white playing within me and consider the green and violet and the tufted crown intentional. This is a mystical moment. A moment where inner and outer come together in unity. But Whitman does not rest in this ecstasy. There's a restlessness in him that keeps him looking around at other creatures, accepting each for what it is, hungry, we might say, to observe more and more individual creatures so he can marvel at the unique identity of each. And do not call the tortoise unworthy because she is not something else. And the mockingbird in the swamp never studied the gamut, yet trills pretty well to me. And the look of the bay mare shames silliness out of me. Notice that the mockingbird, who has never studied the gamut, the bird has never been to music school to learn the different scales or gamuts. No book learning for this swampy mockingbird. And yet it trills pretty well to me. Pretty well indeed. And that bay mare, reddish-brown, shaming the silliness out of me. All the trifling nonsense we always bring to whatever we're doing. It takes a good dose of nature to shame this out of us and ground us in something deeper and more lasting. And I suppose poetry can also shame silliness out of us. If so, Whitman's as good as anyone else to do this for us, with us. Here's our passage once more, as we come to the close of our evening together under lamplight. The butcher boy puts off his killing clothes, or sharpens his knife at the stall in the market. I loiter, enjoying his repartee and his shuffle and breakdown. Blacksmiths with grimed and hairy chests environ the anvil. Each has his main sledge. They are all out. There is a great heat in the fire. From the cinder-strewed threshold I follow their movements. The lithe shear of their waists plays even with their massive arms. Overhand the hammers roll, overhand so slow, overhand so sure. They do not hasten. Each man hits in his place. The Negro holds firmly the reins of his four horses. The block swags underneath on its tied-over chain. The Negro that drives the huge dray of the stone yard. Steady and tall, he stands poised on one leg on the string piece. His blue shirt exposes his ample neck and breast and loosens over his hip band. His glance is calm and commanding. He tosses the slouch of his hat away from his forehead. The sun falls on his crispy hair and mustache, falls on the black of his polished and perfect limbs. I behold the picturesque giant and love him. And I do not stop there. I go with the team also. In me, the caresser of life, wherever moving, backward as well as forward slewing, to niches aside and junior bending. Oxen that rattle the yoke or halt in the shade, what is it that you express in your eyes? It seems to me more than all the print I have read in my life. My tread scares the wood drake and wood duck on my distant and day-long ramble. They rise together, they slowly circle around. I believe in those winged purposes, and acknowledge the red, yellow, and white playing within me, and consider the green and violet and the tufted crown intentional. And do not call the tortoise unworthy because she is not something else. And the mockingbird in the swamp never studied the gamut, yet trills pretty well to me. And the look of the bay mare shames silliness out of me. That's it for this evening under lamplight. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, thanking you for attending to us here on Cambridge 105. We're going out now with Raphael Wolfish playing John Taverner's Thrinos for Solo Cello, a good way to raise us above whatever silliness remains at this point.